2020, take one.
We have conducted a long survey of values in Hungarian society. What are the main results, the main findings of your survey? How much has the communist ethos permeated Hungarian society since 1945?
Well, the impact has been ambivalent, I would say. There have been some important changes in people's value beliefs in the last 30 or 40 years. But at the same time, there are many continuities which one wouldn't expect. The changes, which are important, on the one hand positive and on the other hand negative, the positive ones, that people began to believe that they have the right to live as free citizens in this country, which was not really the rule before the war. So people have been accustomed to know that they have their own rights to a decent life.
They discovered that in the communist regime.
Yes, quite interesting, because in the 40s at least, in the early 50s, in spite of the Stalinist regime, the revolutionary ideology that you are free men, you are citizens, you have the right to live as free citizens. This ideology had its own impact, and it did socialize people in this new ethos, I would say, in spite of the fact that in reality people did not get freedom and didn't get equality and didn't get really a kind of social security. But these values have been imbued in people's minds in spite of their absence in practical life, which is an important change, I think, in this society. On the other hand, there have been many negative effects of the new system and the new ideology. Mainly the main, most important one is what we call here the total atomization of society. The society has been disintegrated, on the one hand, voluntarily, systematically by the new leaders, by the new system. On the other hand, they have got atomized by the new reality, by the new economic, political, and social institutions. So nowadays, Hungary is, I think, in the world, one of the most atomized, disintegrated society of harsh individualists who don't care about anything else than their own life and the family lives.
Now, you've made a comparison in your study with Western countries. What singles out Hungary? What is the main contrast between a socialist country and the West European countries?
Oh, there are many differences, but one of the main ones is what I have just mentioned. We had a comparative survey comparing Hungary with the United States of America, which is a nonsense to compare a small country to a big one, but we had to do this. And there our main finding was that Hungarians are more individualistic and more egoistic than the Americans, which is a nonsense, but it is true. In a special sense, it is true. We call this negative individuation, a kind of individualism without values, without a worldview. It's a kind of instinctive, acquisitive, materialistic individualism, which is really, I think, the main feature of Hungarian people nowadays. Later on, we took part in an international project, which is called the European Value Systems Study, which was organized in Great Britain. And about 15 European countries took part in this international project, Hungary included, the only socialist country. And here again, we had the same results, Hungary as the most individualistic country in Europe, on the one hand. On the other hand, which is not very favorable for us, that Hungarians are pretty conservative as far as, for instance, moral values are concerned. We are as conservative as the Irish or the Italians in some important moral aspects.
You're talking about an atomized society, but you've also coined the phrase the second society. where does this second society come from? How can you define this concept?
I see. In the 50s, I think, we living here in Eastern Europe, in Hungary and other countries, we had the impression, the false impression, that we live in a country which can be described as a one-actor game, that there is only the party who is acting, or which is acting, and people are only obeying. But in the 60s, we get the impression more and more that it's a false impression, that these countries and the life in these countries cannot be described by this one-actor model, but it could be much better described by a multi-actor model. And then we try to see who these several actors could be and what kind of interactions are going on in these countries which are formerly one-party systems. How can and where can we discover a kind of latent pluralism or latent pluralistic interactions in the field of culture, social life, political life, and so on and so forth. So we were looking for an alternative society beneath the surface of the official first society. And then hypothetically we call this second alternative society the second.
Is it mainly connected with the second economy?
The second economy could be only a part of the second society. We try to define the official society by the help of a set of criteria, and we were asking if perhaps there is another field or sphere of social existence where different criteria, different organizational principles are at work. And so we tried to distinguish between the first official society and an alternative second society working according to different rules of the game.
People live a sort of schizophrenic existence. They're part of their existence. They have to conform to the party norms. In other spheres of their existence, they have autonomy and they obey to different values.
We had this impression at that time. I have to admit that later on, in the 70s and early 80s, we had to develop this hypothesis because it was not really borne out by facts. And then we found that there are not only two, let's say, societies or social dimensions, but there is a whole range of different what we call organizational principles, which are organizing the economic, social, and political life in these countries. And so we found a whole plurality of incompatible, diverse organizing principles. For instance, in Hungarian economy, there are at least three sets of rules of the game which are interfering with one another. We have the system of a planned economy. We have also rules of the market economy, and we have also very important mechanisms which we call the administrative market, which is a completely different set of rules of the game, operating at the same time and interfering with the other two others. And the same we have found in political life, that beside the rules of the game of the one-party system, we have also the statist bureaucratic rules of the game. Then again, we have oligarchic organizing principles. We have clientelistic rules and mechanisms. We have the mechanisms of a kind of enlightened paternalistic absolutism. And also we have a slowly emerging set of democratic principles. And now these various rules or sets of rules are again interacting and making a havoc of the country, making a chaos, maybe a fertile or unfertile chaos in this country.
And how strong is this democratic principle that you mentioned, that there are several operating principles, but how strong is this emerging democratic principle?
Yes, relatively, if you look at these things from Eastern Europe, then they become stronger and stronger. If you look at us from the West, they might seem insignificant. And I would say that when we speak about democratic principles, then I use the word in a very wide sense. I include, for instance, corporatist mechanisms in this concept.
10:22. There's a great deal of talk about necessity of combining economic and political reform. In Poland, the pressure for reform came from the society. In Hungary, it seems to come from the economy. What are the pressures for political reform, and what kind of political reform is feasible, according to you, in this system?
I agree with you that in Poland, the pressure came mainly from the masses, and the pressures were mainly political, at least in the early 80s. While in Hungary, this whole slow process of liberalization throughout the 60s and 70s and early 80s, these were mainly strivings for economic reforms. But I wouldn't say that these pressures came only from above in Hungary. I think that there were important pressures also from below here, not on the scale of mass movements, but many, many micro pressures which aggregated to very important forces and in a way pushed the government or pushed the party, even forced the party to implement reforms, change the course of this country several times. So I think these micro pressures were very important or have been very important throughout this period also in Hungary. As far as political reforms are concerned, yes, everybody knows in Hungary, and everybody has been knowing for 20 years, that economic reforms cannot succeed without deep going political reforms. I would say that this is a common sense in this country. Everybody knows it. That's an evidence. And the main question nowadays, I think, in these weeks, when the whole country boils with reform programs and plans and ideas for social reforms and for political reforms, is the question, how is it possible that everybody has been for reforms for 20 years and very, very little happened? Why? Where is this? A ghost may be haunting this country. I would see a wicked, invisible hand which just breaks down reform movements. And we are looking for where is this ghost, this evil, which obstructs these reform wishes or reform pressures or reform programs of coming from all sides in the country.
Where do you think it is, the ghost?
Oh, there are several. You know that in folk tales there are at least seven evils or wicked persons. Now, also in Hungary we have found at least seven. I can give you four, five, six, or seven, or as many. There are many ones. Those who point to one group or to another group, saying that they are the wicked one, of course, I'm mistaken. I don't believe that managers in the great enterprises are the only wicked people, or people up on the political echelon. They are the only wicked people, or anybody else. I think that they're very, a very complex situation. The whole system is dysfunctioning. Some evils. For instance, there are people who say that the main problem in Hungary is that everybody has very decent and honest wishes and programs and interests, but the institutions which we have are unable to coordinate these various interests and various wishes and various strivings. So the bad institutional system would be the culprit, would be ghost obstructing reforms, according to other people.
The party is, after all, the core of these institutions.
Yes, that would be my fifth fifth factor in this picture. We may go on with the party. Yes, there are people in Hungary and outside Hungary who say that in these East European countries, the ruling elite is not really the ruling elite which would be able to implement these reforms, which would be able to launch a dynamic economic and political reform, because in these countries, this ruling elite is in transformation, And those people who are at present ruling the country are not the real people who should rule the country. For instance, an English expert, he's called Parkin, has a theory that the bureaucracy is not really the appropriate elite in these countries, but it would be the intelligentsia. Because in these highly complex societies, bureaucrats are unable to govern the country, but intellectuals would be. That's his idea. And also, would agree with, they did agree with this 10 years ago. They wouldn't agree anymore with this nowadays. And according to another theory, elites all over the world have a very difficult problem to solve. They have to combine or coordinate or harmonize two contradictory goals. On the one hand, every elite has the justified wish to keep power, to remain on power, to conserve the political status quo. On the other hand, they have to integrate society. They have to involve people, and so they have to in a way, secure a steady economic growth. And these two goals become frequently incompatible. And according to this hypothesis, the Hungarian elite is unable to handle this contradiction. In 1 year, they understand that they have to implement reforms. The next year, they are scared from the results. They are getting back everything or almost everything to preserve their power. Then again, the economy goes down. Again, they implement reforms. Again, they have to draw back the whole process. So this oscillation between two goals, this may be one of the sources of the present stalemate and the present critical situation in this country.
1023, take one.
One of the features of Eastern European societies ever since the 19th century was that they adopted a Western model. They were looking toward the West for inspiration in terms of the social, economic, or political development, but never quite fulfilled that promise or that hope. And that brings with it a certain number of frustrations. So what is today the image of the West or of the West? Is there a Western model still? And what is the state of these frustrations? What are the neuroses that it produces in society?
Yeah. Sure, we still live in this neurosis of backwardness, and this neurosis that we have to catch up with the West. And this is a heavy burden. This is a heavy heritage, I would say, in this country. On the one hand, this is drawing the country on this road of development, but at the same time, it causes great difficulties. For instance, aspirations have exploded after the Second World War, because the model of the Western way of life was so strong, and then of course people were frustrated, and they are still frustrated. But I think in Hungary there's a kind of change of the framework, or the frame of reference in people's minds. In the last 5 or 10 years, people have turned more and more towards Eastern Europe. And this is a much more positive reference frame for our egos or for our self-esteem, because then we can feel that we have nevertheless achieved something if we compare ourselves to our East European neighbors. So now we have a double reference frame with ambivalent and ambiguous impacts on our emotional state, I would say.